Judge Bratfold, Judge Siegel, the Honorable Louise Dovray Bjorkman presiding.
Good morning. Am I the only one who does not see Judge Siegel?
Let's see.
Now I do. All right. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals on this lovely April 22nd, 2020, Earth Day, I think 50th anniversary, in fact. We are here. The first matter on the court's calendar today is Dane Limited versus Teflon Edwards. Counsel, are you able to both hear and see the judges and the iPad on which the time will be kept?
Yes, Your Honor, but I'm having trouble viewing the time on the iPad.
It does get bigger. Can you see that?
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Right. And counsel, for appellant, you were able to see it as well?
Yes. Yes, like now I am. Thank you.
Okay.
Great. Well, I'm going to, both of you are familiar with the procedures. You will each get 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And when you are ready, and it's also important you state your name and identify the party that you represent, because we are, as usual, recording these proceedings. With that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Jeffrey Ali with Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. And I'm here today on behalf of the appellant Teflon Edwards. Real briefly to set the context for what happened at the underlying trial before judge review, the landlord brought three claims: a claim for non-payment of rent, breaches of the lease, a few claims of breaches of the lease, and what's called a holdover, meaning that the landlord claimed that he gave a notice to vacate to the tenant, the appellant, asking the tenants to leave by a particular date. By the time the case was submitted for a decision to the housing court referee, the claims of breach of lease were either dismissed by the court or voluntarily withdrawn. The claim for non-payment of rent was not decided, because the housing court referee did decide the claim of holdover, and referee hoteling ruled in favor of the landlord. And then in her written decision said that because the claim of holdover was dispositive, that she was not reaching the issue of non-payment of rent. When the claim of holdover was added to the case, it wasn't originally cut. It was added at what's called the first appearance, but it was not ripe when it was added. I think the landlord probably admits that, but the referee found that she said that in the trial. And then on review, Judge Peralta found that the claim was not only ripe when added by a motion to amend at the first appearance before it had matured into a claim, there was no amended or supplemental pleading ever filed with the court, and in violation of Rule 603 of the General Rules of Practice, the written notice to vacate was not attached to any pleading.
Counsel, I think I'm familiar with the background, and I think everyone agrees that there are procedural, that the housing court referee's decision was procedurally flawed for the reasons you suggest. But what difference does that make at this point, given the fact that your client did not pay monthly rent for May or June or make a deposit or post a bond as the court required back in July?
Well, Your Honor, you raised a couple of issues there. Judge Peralta decided, without using the word, that the case was moot because Mr. Edwards did not post the bond, right? But to stay entry of the judgment and execution of the writ of recovery of the premises. But Rule 6 and 11 of the General Rules of Practice does not require one to post a bond. So he had the choice whether to post the bond or not. It is not that he did not pay rent. The issue of non-payment of rent was not decided, and referee hoteling never issued a redemption order. A redemption order under 549.211, I believe, of the housing code says that You know, if the tenant posts or pays rent to the landlord anytime before disposition of the case, or that the possessed of the property, then the tenant redeems, right? But redemption is an unconditional right then to have possession of the property, just to remain in possession of the property. An appeal bond or a review bond is not an unconditional right to remain in possession of the property. It is just providing security to the landlord. In the event that the tenant loses, the landlord has relief. There is no security that the landlord needed here because the tenant is no longer there.
But Mark, if an eviction proceeding is all about who has present possessory interest or rights, and we know here that by the time this case got to the judicial review hearing, your client no longer was in possession, what relief could the court have awarded?
Well, if someone gets evicted, and these are the cases I briefed to Judge Peralta, and he ignored in his decision, or he's not addressed in his decision, respectfully. The law is that if a tenant is involuntarily dispossessed of the property, then the case is not moot. If a tenant voluntarily leaves the property, then the case is moot. So here the tenant was evicted. The only question is, well, was he, you know, did he have to pay the bond? And the answer is no. The rules of practice don't require him to pay a bond. And there are cases all the time that go to the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court where tenants have been evicted. And then the decision, the question comes down to, was the eviction proper or not? Was it legal or not?
Right? So can I interrupt just for a minute, Mr. Ali? So are you claiming that the referee abused his discretion by ordering the payment of rent in order to continue the stay of the writ of recovery? I mean, there is this kind of, I know it's the posture of the case is that it's a holdover and not failure to pay rent, I guess. But was that an abuse of discretion, in your opinion?
It's not an abuse.
Require the bond?
No, the referee can't issue an order like that, requiring someone to post a bond. In fact, I think has to, because the tenant is allowed to post the bond if the tenant wants to stay in possession for the period of pendency of a judge review or the appeal. Okay? But that is not a redemption order. That is not payments of rent, respectfully. I think, you know, Judge Peralta, and I hope this court doesn't confuse us either, confuses the issue of payment of rent with payment of a bond. It's not payment of rent. It's payment of a certain sum of money as security to the landlord, right? It is based on the rent, sure, but it is not a redemption because if he pays the bond, the case doesn't go away. If you pay a redemption order, the case goes away. So he can choose whether or not to post that bond, but that doesn't deprive him of then relief on judicial review or in the Court of Appeals.
Mr. Ali, let me ask you this. Is there any evidence here that your client was unable to pay the May and June monthly rent, as in fact he proposed when requesting judicial review?
Your Honor, the case, I think the first day of trial was June 4th. Right? The case was brought before June. So the issue of non-payment of June was never even an issue in the case. The issue of non-payment of rent for May was an issue in the case. He tried to tender at least some, if not all, of the May rent to the landlord, but the landlord refused it because under the law, if the landlord accepts rent, the landlord then waives any claim for breach. And if landlord accepts rent, right, for the month of May, when he's demanded that the tenant vacate before May 1st on the last day of April, then he's waived or voided his notice to vacate. So the landlord...
Counsel, my question is, I guess, a little bit different. Didn't your client, when requesting judicial review, specifically propose as a way to stay the writ of recovery that he would pay monthly rent for May and June?
I can't remember. I mean, the thing is, usually these orders for possible stay of execution of the writ are on the order of like 48 hours. So what we do is sometimes we just ask for a stay so we can get a hold of our client. to find out if the client has the money or wants to pay or what does not want to pay to stay the execution of the writ, right? So I think I may have asked for a stay of the execution of the writ, and then I may have withdrawn that either before, well, probably after speaking with the client, because I wouldn't do that without the client's consent. Now, a redemption order is usually on the order of like a week. Usually posting a bond is on the order of like 2 days. There's no evidence in the record, and it's really, frankly, respectfully, not relevant as to whether or not he could have paid within those 2 days the rent for May or June or May and June. That's not the issue. He is the option. It can be strategic, or, you know, it can be because he can't pay. But it's up to the party seeking judicial review if they want to post the bond or not. That merely stays entry of the judgment. But that doesn't mean then if the tenant does not post the bond and the tenant then is dispossessed because of execution of the writ, the tenant is then without relief. What happens is the case is not moot, is because what happens is because the holdover should have never been entertained in the first place, the holdover should have never been tried. And I think maybe this court has already decided this. The holdover was improvidently decided against Mr. Edwards. The decision on the holdover should be vacated. This case should be sent back. And then Referee Hotelling should make findings of fact and issue a redemption order so Mr. Edwards can pay a redemption order. And then he can stay unconditionally on the premises as if the case had never been brought in the first place. And that's what he wants to do and is willing to do. He's currently homeless.
So can I ask one more question? It seems like the district court was wrestling with the issue of your client is the appellant is already out of the apartment. And I mean, it's possible, I suppose, that there might be a new tenant in that apartment. So what remedy or what authority would the court have, you know, in that situation where he's already left and vacated, and there, I'm assuming there's no evidence in the record about whether it's occupied by somebody, by a new tenant or not.
No, there's nothing in the record on this point. It's outside the record. It's really not, you know, germane to these proceedings, but this happens in housing court every day, right? So this would be sent back to Referee Hotelling. And we could negotiate a settlement. She can make factual findings and make a decision on non-payment. And in the meantime, I guess we'll find out if Mr. Kruger or Dane Limited has rented this out to someone else. But that's his problem. He also owns dozens of properties. And again, this is outside the record, but I think he owns dozens of properties in the Northeast neighborhood. So he and Mr. Edwards had a tenancy. A lease agreement. And if he can't provide that property, Mr. Edwards is entitled to the benefit of the bargain. So Mr. Kruger, the principal of Dane Limited, can offer to put him into another property. And I imagine because he's got several dozens of properties, he's probably got one available for Mr. Edwards to move back into. But the district court judge didn't put any of this stuff, any of these issues in his decision. All he said is because the bond wasn't posted, he could not provide any relief. And, you know, Real Estate Equity Strategies versus Jones, which is 720 Northwest 2nd, 352, which is a decision of this court, the Court of Appeals from 2006, says exactly the opposite. When the owner obtains possession of the property based on an eviction judgment, as long as the tenant is dispossessed of that property involuntarily, and that's what eviction is, then the case is not moot.
But didn't the Jones case involve a record that indicated that Jones was unable to pay the disputed rent due under the lease?
I don't remember. And
does that make a difference in deciding whether the disposition is possession is voluntary or involuntary?
No, no, Your Honor, I'm sorry, respectfully, if a tenant decides to leave before there's a decision, right, before there's a decision on the merits, then the tenant has voluntarily left. But once the decision comes from the court saying you're to be evicted, right? Then there's an eviction judgment, right? And so the tenant is then dispossessed. It doesn't matter whether or not and there's no evidence in this record, and I can't remember if there was evidence in that record of whether or not the tenant can pay or just decides not to pay. But that's irrelevant because any party can always strategically decide not to post a bond, but that doesn't deprive the party seeking relief from relief. But in this case, there's no evidence that Mr. Edwards could not post the bond. And as I said in the brief, and as I've said now, he wants to pay the rent and move back in. And there is a procedure for that. The housing court deals with this all the time. And that's a decision, that's an issue for us to deal with in the future. And the issue of redemption, how much Mr. Edwards owes in back rent, is an issue for Referee Hotelling upon this case being sent back down. See, my time is out, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent. I can't hear you. There you go.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. May it please the court. I'm Clarice Garnecchia, and I'm here on behalf of respondent Dane Limited LLC. This case is first and foremost moot because there is no controversy. Eviction actions are about immediate possession of property, and the appellant voluntarily gave up possession of the property when he voluntarily opted not to pay the rent. Even if the case is not moot, the district court did not err in affirming the referee's order because it correctly relied on the harmless error rule. Therefore, respondent asked this court to affirm the order of the district court. Now, first, I want to talk about mootness. The general rule is that eviction proceedings do not address matters other than immediate right to possession of the property. Now, when the plaintiff obtained possession only by force of a judgment, the case may not necessarily be moot. And that's something that Scroggins v. Sochaga and Fis v. Toner addressed. However, and Jones also stated that failure to post a bond did not necessarily render the case moot, that it was a factor of involuntariness in that particular case. But
how do we decide whether a failure to deposit money, obtain a bond, whatever the condition of the stay is voluntary versus involuntary?
It depends on the facts. So in this case, it was voluntary because there was an undisputed issue of non-payment of rent. And we have that even though the holdover was under review, the defendant voluntarily failed to post rent when there existed this uncontested issue of non-payment. So the appellant requested review of the holdover. That was a voluntary act. They voluntarily requested that the order be stayed under the rule, and they requested that in their order for review. They also voluntarily requested that the bond be equated to his rent. Then they failed to dispute the amount of bond, so they never argued that the amount of bond set was incorrect, and they voluntarily did not make the posting after that.
How is this different than Johnson, in which case our court said the failure to post the bond was involuntary because of inability to pay?
So one of the biggest differences from a lot of the case law, such as Jones and Sochaga, is because the judgment would not stay with the appellant's requested relief. Now, the appellant is asking, if you look at the reasoning in Sochaga, the issue was not moot because the judgment could no longer stand after dismissal of the underlying action. Now, dismissal of the holdover would still leave a judgment in favor of the landlord on the non-payment of rent issue, because the redemption order is still a judgment in favor of the landlord. And it would still be in favor of the landlord because the non-payment of rent issue was ultimately undisputed. And we know it was undisputed and uncontested because the appellant admitted during the trial that the rent was unpaid. There was a factual finding from the court referee that the rent was unpaid. The appellant asked in the request for review that the rent be posted as a bond, and the appellant never challenged the bond amount at any hearing, which he is allowed to do under Rule 611. And the appellant is not asking for a dismissal. That is so important here. The appellant is asking for redemption, which means the ability to pay the rent and stay, but that also means there is no change in judgment in favor of the landlord. So that's why there's, in summary, the mootness issue here is mainly because this case is very different from the case law from Jones and Solchaga and other case law, because the judgment itself would not change. And in those cases, the appellant or the tenant was always arguing that the case should all be dismissed or that the judgment should change. And second, we have a lot of factual issues that point to the vacating being voluntary because there's no dispute about the rent. And we can look at why the tenant didn't pay. There's only two real reasons why the appellant couldn't pay the bond. Either he didn't have the money or he didn't want to stay. If he voluntarily did not pay, then he did not want to stay in possession of the property because the order for review allowed the appellant to pay and stay in the property while the review was ongoing. And if that's the case, then he voluntarily vacated and the case is now moot. If he could not afford to pay, the ability to pay is not a defense in a non-payment case. So he would have been required to pay the amount in order to stay in possession, which does not change the obligation to pay the rent, which was the same as the bond, or the outcome, which is judgment in favor of the landlord. So in conclusion, regarding the moot issue, the writ was not issued because of the holdover in dispute. It was issued because appellant could not choose or chose not to, the appellant chose not to or could not pay the undisputed amount of rent. So there's no further relief that could be granted because it was the same as the bond posting. And what I want to mention before I conclude mootness is that the district court actually did not make a determination about the mootness. They decided that the case ultimately should be affirmed because of the harmless error rule. And mootness and harmless error are very, very different. And they're different because all of the cases that Mr. Ali cites, like Jones and Solchaga, are about mootness. Now with the harmless error, they're saying that, well, the other case law actually doesn't apply because we're not saying that the case is moot. The district court actually didn't make a determination on whether it was moot or not. They're saying that there's legal consequences of not posting the bond.
Ms. Garnecchia, can I just ask you a question? Didn't your client, create the conundrum that the district court found itself in by choosing to proceed along a holdover theory and refusing to accept May rent? So it seems like your client's trying to have its cake and eat it too, by saying, oh, non-payment of rent, oh, but I'm not going to accept your rent because a quicker path for me to get you out of here is on the holdover. And in fact, that's what the review was. And Mr. Ali is arguing, wait a minute, but then there's a right to redemption. And so how does that factor in? I mean, it seems like your client, now you're arguing mootness, but your client in fact created this situation. So why isn't there a right to redemption as Mr. Ali is arguing for his client?
There's no right of redemption here because the appellant was already given the right of redemption. And that's what the district court talked about when they talked about harmless error. Now, the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure allow for harmless error. They allow for procedural rules. It's not enough for appellant to simply show the mere existence of an error. They also have to show they were prejudiced. And there's no prejudice here because there's no change in the appellant's material obligation to pay rent. The appellant never paid the rent prior to, never tried to pay the rent prior to. And when we had the posting or the bond order saying, okay, this is your chance to pay the rent and stay. And the bond order actually gave appellant more time to pay the past due rent. And there's also no change in the obligation because
But at the time that the housing court referee made its decision, it wasn't a past due rent situation. It was a holdover situation.
But it also was a past due rent situation. So you had the past due rent for May and the past due rent for June at the time that the district court made their decision. And under 504B.291, the redemption order requires that the tenant pay the amount outstanding. It doesn't say that they pay the only the amount pled in the complaint, so they're not required to only pay May. They're required to pay May, June, July, whatever month that that actual order is issued. So when the district court order came out saying that, well, the holdover issue, we're going to decide in favor of the landlord on the holdover issue, and then the appellant asked for review and then a bond posting was ordered, they were actually given more time to pay because the district court order, if they made a finding on the non-payment, would have given them at most, and they do not have to give them this amount of time, 7 days under the statute to pay the amount that's overdue plus cost of the action, which meant not just May, but all the rent that was due at the time of the order plus the costs, which means the court filing fee, the service fees, and $5 of attorney's fees. And by this order for review, which was after the district court order and after the 7 day period, they were actually given more time to pay the outstanding rent, and they weren't even required to post the attorney's fees or the filing fees, which would also be due under a redemption order. And I want to go back to the harmless error argument. So there's no change in the appellant's material obligation to pay rent. That's the biggest part about the harmless error. And there's no change in the judgment in favor of the landlord with appellant's requested relief. And it was because of appellant's requested relief was redemption and not dismissal. That's why there's the harmless error. They're saying you were given the exact same opportunity to pay and stay in possession of the property, and you failed to do so. You failed to try to post any type of rent. So there's no guarantee that the tenant could actually pay the rent. So why give him another opportunity that potentially displaces an innocent third party, which, even though Mr. Ali says happens all the time, certainly does not happen all the time, and creates a large amount of legal problems afterwards, and then also creates this idea of a floodgate of cases then coming afterwards saying that, oh, we don't have to post rent, even though there's no legal consequences whatsoever for not being able to post bond. Well, then we're just going to ask for review, and we're going to appeal every single action we can just to delay the obligation to pay rent, which is going to, if you can go back, going to displace more innocent third parties. It creates a lot of legal problems if you don't rely on the harmless error rule. And I want to go back to touch on appellant's argument regarding the bond. So they're arguing that review was ultimately conditioned upon the bond. But first, they're saying that that's because, and they're saying that, well, the district court decided that it was moot. The district court did not say that the case was moot. They decided on the harmless error part. And that's different because of the case law, and because we're saying that, well, we're not requiring the bond, but there are still legal consequences for not paying the bond in certain factual situations, like what happened here. And that's because the non-payment issue was non-disputed. And that's because the appellant's request of relief was the same relief that he was granted earlier, to pay and stay in possession of the property. Not requiring a bond also creates a very dangerous precedent. It's actually, the rule is very clear regarding the stay. The filing and service of a notice of review does not stay entry of a judgment nor vacate a judgment if already entered, unless the petitioner requests and the referee orders a bond, payment in lieu of a bond, or waiver of bond and payment.
So in this case, where there was no payment of a bond, I mean, what was then even the point of the August 29th review hearing?
Well, the appellate was trying to make the, I made the argument of mootness at the review hearing. I made the argument of mootness and harmless error at the review hearing, because I don't think that any relief could be granted. An appellant was still trying to have his cake and eat it too by saying, no, I know I didn't post the bond, but I want that opportunity to pay and stay. which was the same exact thing that he failed to do earlier, but he just wanted to choose when to do it, which isn't legally right. And the stay is conditioned on bond only if the party asks for it. So the appellant voluntarily requested the bond and voluntarily proposed that the bond be the rent owed, which again are factors of voluntariness going towards the mootness argument. Also, we have no change in material obligations. That is very key here. The tenant is required to pay rent under the lease and asked for the same relief under judicial review. And again, because we're talking about harmless error, because we're talking about a case that factually differs a lot, Jones and Salchaga do not apply. Jones talks about mootness. It does not say there cannot be any legal consequences of choosing not to post a bond. And Jones ultimately disputed the filing of an eviction and the amount owed. Here, there is no dispute that the tenant owed the rent and the appellant wants to pay the rent and stay, which is the same opportunity they were given at the bond hearing. Because think of if they actually posted the bond, then we would have had this appeal, or the district court would have found, you know, there's an error in the holdover. Let's go back and revert to the make a finding on the non-payment. If the appellant was still in possession of the property at that time, then he would have been allowed the chance to pay and stay because they would have issued a redemption order, which likely would be almost the same amount that was posted into court. And then that would have been paid and he would have continued to stay. So it was because of the relief and because he didn't post the bond, that's why the district court found there's no further relief that can be granted. We're not giving him a second bite at the apple. We're going to find that even though there were some errors. Is my time up? I'm sorry.
You may complete your sentence.
Thank you. Even though there were some errors, any errors were harmless because no further relief could be granted. Thank you, Your Honor.
Do either of my panel members have additional questions for Respondents' Counsel?
I do not.
Thank you. Counsel for Appellant, then you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Siegel kind of hit the nail on the head when she asked the Landlord's Counsel if this wasn't just setting up Mr. Edwards, right? Because remember, there's no findings of fact on the non-payment of rent. The non-payment of rent was not tried. I know counsel wants to turn this into a non-payment of rent case, but it was a holdover case. The non-payment of rent was not, there were no findings on that. And what little is in the record on the non-payment of rent issue is that Mr. Edwards did try to pay rent, but the landlord refused. And as I explained earlier, the landlord—
So the record was— Wasn't it undisputed that there had been no payment? I know there wasn't a finding of fact, but it wasn't a contested thing, was it? I mean, he had not paid May or June rent.
But he can't hold a gun to the landlord's head and make the landlord take the rent. He tried to pay
it. I understand that, yes.
He tried to pay the rent. That's the issue, right? Did he tender the rent and did the landlord refuse the rent? So there, that was, you know, we got into a little bit at the trial, but the trial came down to holdover because the landlord refused the rent and he said, I'm not going to take your rent. I'm going to file an eviction action against you instead. He didn't take it because if he had accepted it, it would have made the written notice to vacate null and void. It would have made the breach claims go away. So landlords do this all the time. They decide themselves, or because they're smart enough to know they've done this before and they know the law, or their lawyers tell them, don't take the rent because as soon as you take it, you're waiving your rights. It's so wrong, right? It's just simply not true that there is no dispute about the non-payment of rent. It was disputed. He tried to pay May. It was refused. The case was filed in May. June is not an issue. Of course, June was not paid because we're at a first appearance in May. The landlord's not accepting May. He's not going to accept June either. So this was not a non-payment or rent case. And as Judge Siegel pointed out, what the landlord is doing then is he's setting up the tenant. He's gonna file breach claims, he's gonna file a holdover claim, and he's gonna file a non-payment claim. Right? Now, if in every breach and non-payment case, later on, after the landlord loses on breach and non-payment or breach and holdover, the landlord can say, well, you didn't pay the rent, you should be evicted on that basis. That makes the whole system then a mockery, because then tenants can never win. So the landlord or the tenant was not given the right to redeem, right? That's a mischaracterization in their brief, and they want to turn this case into a non-payment case. It's not a non-payment case. He was not given the right to redeem because he was not given the right to pay money and then stay there unconditionally, right? Because if he was given that right, we wouldn't have had a judge review it, and we wouldn't be talking here today. And June was not an issue because both the landlord and the housing court don't care about the rules, right? The pleading was signed in May. The case was put on first appearance in May. June was never an issue in the case. So maybe if the case is sent back down, then yeah, there'll be an issue as to, well, how long was he in there in June, and what's the appropriate amount he has to pay to redeem for the time he was in there in June. But landlords don't take payment for rent in the month they're trying the case, because then the case goes away. And then for the landlord to argue that this was harmless error, I think is frankly nonsensical. Of course it's harmful error, because the tenant was evicted. And then finally, Judge Bjorkman, I think you asked a very good question, which calls into the whole point of the general rule of practice, Rule 611. There would be no point to review if the tenant always had to pay the bond, right? The review, the rule of practice says, A, here's what happens if you pay the bond. Here, B, here's what happens if you don't pay the bond. If in every case the tenant didn't pay the bond, then there'd be no review if the law were as the landlord would like it to be in this case.
Or at least no effective review.
Right, and what would the point of having the reviews be, right? Why would we have spent all this time, effort, and money since that, once again, these proceedings? That would make no sense. So that is all I have. I appreciate the court's attention and consideration.
Any additional questions from the panel?
No.
All right. Thank you both for your helpful arguments. I appreciate your willingness to proceed with oral arguments under these circumstances. I think we've been having good experience overall with this WebEx meeting or format, and I appreciate your participation, and we will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Well.